From Feature Story News in Washington and our bureaus around the world, this is FSN Reports. I'm Kevin McAleese. On today's programme, a taped phone call seemingly involving the Assistant Secretary of State looks set to overshadow the US diplomat's visit to Ukraine.
So that would be great, I think, to help glue this thing and have the UN help glue it. And, you know, the EU.
We have the latest from Capitol Hill as the Senate fails to restore unemployment benefits. We have a special report on the drugs war between US pharmaceutical companies and South Africa. And we delve into the world of the international art thief following the theft of a priceless violin.
It's one of about 650 that are known throughout the world. Stradivarius in and of themselves are very valuable. This particular one is valued anywhere between $3 and $6 million.
That's coming up on FSN Reports after our latest summary of the day's headlines.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Rebecca Foster. Long-awaited talks have been held between the Pakistan government and pro-Taliban representatives in the country's capital. After a bloody decade-long insurgency, the sides formally entered peace negotiations with a view to ending the violence and setting off on what the Pakistan government described as a journey for peace. Islamabad-based journalist Annabelle Symington says the talks have been met with cautious optimism.
These are talks to sketch out a framework within which proper peace talks can happen. So this is still very much a baby step, and people are skeptical about the chances of success.
The 2014 Winter Olympics in Sochi are officially getting underway amid tight security. The opening ceremony's been preceded by warnings from the U.S. that explosives hidden in toothpaste tubes could be smuggled onto planes flying to Russia for the Games. Russia has put a vast security operation in place, boosted after two suicide attacks in the city of Volgograd in December and several threats from militants in the Caucasus region. Some qualifying events have already started in Sochi. FSN's Anya Ardayeva is there.
Athletes and spectators from around the world are arriving in Sochi, where the Winter Olympic Games are set to open on Friday. The games are taking place amid unprecedented security measures following two deadly suicide attacks in the Russian city of Volgograd late last year, which killed 34 people. Russia has put local security on high alert 1 month before the games, and Russian President Vladimir Putin has ordered additional police and soldiers to be sent to Sochi. A total of 40,000 security personnel are now working in the area.
Seven bombs have killed at least five people in Baghdad and wounded more than 40 others, hours after U.S. lawmakers criticized Iraq's Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki for the slow pace of reconciliation, which they said was fueling the violence. The attacks come as security forces struggle to contain the worst violence since 2008, with a general election looming in April. Nina Maria Potts has more.
With no let-up in the bloodshed, U.S. lawmakers appealed directly to Iraqi Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki to do more to reach out to the Sunni Arab minority. His government came in for direct criticism on Wednesday, with U.S. House Foreign Affairs Committee Chairman Ed Royce saying the Iraqi Prime Minister has got to do more to address Sunni grievances and that his failure to do so far had stoked the worsening violence.
An audio tape in which senior Obama administration figures discuss the crisis in Ukraine and express frustration over the European Union's approach to the protests there has suddenly been leaked on the internet. The apparently bugged conversation between Assistant Secretary of State Victoria Nuland and the U.S. Ambassador to Ukraine, Jeffrey Pyatt, shows the two of them discussing ways in which they might influence the formation of a new Ukrainian government. From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN. There are rising concerns in the U.S. about the implications of a rise in attacks by Islamic militants in Egypt. It follows a series of recent attacks against government targets and a series of recorded propaganda videos encouraging an insurgency campaign. Over 1,100 migrants trying to cross the Mediterranean Sea in inflatable boats to get into Italy have been rescued by the country's navy. It comes as record numbers of African immigrants have been reported by the Italian authorities in recent months. Jack Perrick has more.
The Italian Navy has rescued more than 1,100 migrants crossing the Mediterranean Ocean from North Africa in inflatable boats. They were picked up around 120 miles to the southeast of the Italian island of Lampedusa. Most of the people on the boats are thought to be from sub-Saharan Africa. It's been reported that Italy saw 10 times the amount of immigrants in January of this year compared to 2013, with around 2,000 people landing on the country's shores last month.
A spate of recent scandals within the U.S. military is worrying the man in charge at the Pentagon. The U.S. Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel is calling for an urgent effort to promote ethical behavior within the nation's armed forces. Pentagon spokesman Rear Admiral John Kirby says Chuck Hagel believes the issues need to be addressed with more urgency.
This issue has his full attention, and it's fair to say that he's deeply troubled by it. He's concerned about the health of the force and the health of the strong culture of accountability and responsibility that Americans have come to expect from their military.
And police in the U.S. state of Wisconsin have recovered a rare stolen Stradivarius violin worth an estimated $3 to $5 million. Frank Allman, who plays with the Milwaukee, Wisconsin Symphony Orchestra, was attacked, and his violin was stolen on January 27th after a concert. And that's the latest Feature Story News. Rebecca Foster reporting.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Kevin McAleese. Welcome to FSN Reports. We begin today with an episode that the U.S. government says has caused a new low in the relationship between Washington and Moscow. As anti-government protests in Ukraine continue, Assistant Secretary of State Victoria Nuland spent the day in Kiev Thursday for talks with government and opposition officials. However, her trip was overshadowed by the sudden release of a seemingly bugged telephone conversation between her and the U.S. ambassador to Kiev.
So I don't think Cleach should go into the government. I don't think it's necessary. I don't think it's a good idea.
Mrs. Nuland there expressing anxiety about the possibility of opposition leader Vitaly Klitschko joining the government. And there was more. President Obama's top diplomat to Europe is heard discussing how to get the United Nations more involved in Ukraine to overcome the European Union's inaction on the crisis.
That would be great, I think, to help glue this thing and have the UN help glue it. And, you know, the EU.
No, exactly.
The State Department says Mrs. Nuland has now apologised to EU officials for her salty remarks. For more on the story, I spoke to our chief Washington correspondent, Simon Marks.
The State Department is putting the blame for the release of this tape very firmly at the door of the Russians, even while Jen Psaki, the State Department spokeswoman, said that she wouldn't comment on the specifics of what she referred to as a private conversation. She did go out of her way to intimate that Washington believes the Russians have either been involved in the production of this tape or its dissemination. Here's what she said.
Certainly, we think this is a new low in Russian tradecraft in terms of publicizing, posting. I don't have any other independent details about the origin of the YouTube video. You're right. This has clearly happened overnight and is relatively new. But this is something they've been actively promoting, posting on, tweeting about, and certainly that we feel that represents a new low.
Simon, tell us, what's more damaging, her dismissal of the EU or the U.S.? Or the sign that U.S. diplomats are trying to meddle in the shape of Ukraine's future politics?
Well, they're both very problematic for the State Department, which says that Victoria Nuland in some capacity has offered an apology to the European Union for the comments that she's heard to make on this tape. But in a way, more damaging than those comments is the discussion that she has with the U.S. ambassador about whether or not Vitaly Klitschko, one of the leaders of the opposition movement in Ukraine, should enter the government. And she's heard very forcibly expressing the view that he should not. Jen Psaki, the State Department spokeswoman, was asked whether that's inconsistent with adopting the position that the future of Ukraine is for Ukrainians, not the Obama administration, to decide. Here's how she responded.
It should be no surprise that U.S. officials talk about issues around the world. Of course we do. That's what you do. That's what diplomats do and discuss, especially issues where we've been closely engaged. You know, the secretary met with the opposition this weekend. He stopped by a meeting with the foreign minister. It's up to the people of Ukraine, including officials from both sides, to determine the path forward. But it shouldn't be a surprise that there are discussions about events on the ground.
But it is problematic for the Obama administration, which has been accused for months by the Russians of trying to pre-cook the outcome of these protests in Ukraine and indeed orchestrating them. It is problematic that this conversation was couched in the terms in which it was couched. And there's no question that there is a serious amount of embarrassment at the State Department over the leaking of this audio.
FSN's chief Washington correspondent, Simon Marks. This is FSN Reports. On Thursday, the US Senate failed yet again to restore federal benefits for the long-term unemployed, which expired about 40 days ago. As tens of thousands more people exhaust their state benefits each week, lawmakers and unemployed Americans vowed to keep pushing for renewal of the program going forward. On Capitol Hill, Alice Olstein has the story.
58-year-old mother of four, Hartley Christensen, lost her long-term unemployment benefits in December when Congress failed to renew funding for the program. A resident of Sterling, Illinois, she has been unemployed since August of 2012, when her employer of 8 years laid her off.
It has been below zero here for probably 6 weeks, and I have propane heat. So I have got myself and my four cats corralled in one room out of an 8-room house and praying to God that my pipes aren't going to freeze and burst and cause thousands and thousands of dollars of damage just because we don't get our unemployment. And I have luckily gotten several job interviews, but I'm either too old or I'm overqualified or not qualified for what they exactly want.
Christensen is one of nearly 2 million people across the country who have seen their benefits expire over the past 40 days. She said she feels like her voice and the voices of those in her same situation are not being heard by the Republicans in Congress who voted once again Thursday to filibuster a renewal of benefits.
The senators should realize that we could be their mother, their sister, their brother, that anybody can lose a job at any time. And when you lose a job, it's bad enough. It's humiliating sometimes. And then not to be able, I couldn't get my grandchildren Christmas presents. I have only been able to try to keep this house going without losing it. And they need to just vote. There are unemployed Republicans and Democrats. There's no sense in this craziness.
After failing multiple times to pass a bill over the past few weeks, senators brought a new version to the floor Thursday that met previous Republican demands. It was short-term, lasting only 3 months instead of a full year, and it was paid for and won't add to the deficit. It also included a provision championed by conservative Oklahoma Senator Tom Coburn that would ban those who made over $1 million a year from getting unemployment benefits if they lose their job. Federal tax data shows that more than 2,000 such millionaires received unemployment benefits in 2009. Yet the bill failed by just one vote Thursday, as nearly every Senate Republican, including Coburn, opted to filibuster. Rhode Island Democrat and bill author Jack Reed said even after Thursday's defeat, it's imperative that the Senate keep trying to pass a reauthorization of the program, especially one that sends retroactive benefits to those who have lost them over the past month.
UI helps people to look for work, while at the same time bolstering consumer demand and supporting the economy.
The bill faces an even steeper uphill battle in the Republican-controlled House of Representatives, which has so far refused to even hold a vote on the issue. FSN spoke to California Democrat Mark Takano, a supporter of renewing unemployment benefits, who believes only passage by the Senate can put enough pressure on House Republicans to act.
Every week, more people are added to the rolls, and my district is particularly hard hit by this. In Riverside, California, we have one of the highest unemployment rates in the country, higher than a national average and higher than California's average.
And do you think there's any hope in the House for getting this done?
There is some hope. It's going to be awfully hard for the House to say no if the Senate is able to get to yes. This is just too volatile an issue. Americans know that people are not sitting at home. They know that it's not about laziness. It's about three people searching for every job opening still. There's just not enough jobs going around, and we need to keep these people going. And I'm going to keep fighting here in the Congress, make sure that we get it back on the table.
Senate Democrats vowed to try again soon to renew unemployment benefits, but they quickly left Washington and began their weekends on Thursday afternoon, right after confirming their colleague Max Baucus to be ambassador to China. In Washington, I'm Alice Olstein.
A drugs war has broken out between the US pharmaceutical industry and South Africa, which wants to introduce cheaper generic drugs by cracking down on the ability of multinationals to keep extending the patents on their drugs. Nina Maria Potts reports on a deepening row, which has much wider global implications.
Public Affairs Engagement is the high-profile American lobbying firm that was invited by some of the world's biggest drug companies to craft a campaign, which has since been rejected, aimed at thwarting the South African government's plan to reform its drug patenting laws. The details of that campaign were leaked earlier this month, infuriating South Africa's health minister and activist groups who accuse multinationals of trying to undermine life-saving legislation. The dispute has been festering for some time, but has gotten much nastier recently, prompting the CEO of Public Affairs Engagement, Ambassador James Glassman, to call on South Africa to think twice before it acts.
You know, some of the language that's come out since the talk about our proposal, and it was only just that, a proposal, has really helped, I think, to shut down a lot of discussion. You know, terms like genocide and satanic, that is really not the kind of thing that ought to be encouraged.
The row between the world's pharmaceutical heavyweights and the South African government revolves around the cost of innovative drugs. Patent reforms would allow access to cheaper generic drugs for South Africans. The South African government wants to close a loophole in the current legislation that allows a drug maker to make minor changes to an existing drug or discover a new use for it and then register it as totally new. Médecins Sans Frontières, Doctors Without Borders, is one of several groups which have accused multinational drug companies of trying to undermine South Africa's efforts to introduce life-saving legislation. Judith Ruiz-San Juan is with Doctors Without Borders.
The impact that this patent law, if it's not fixed, is having is an impact of life and death. I mean, from our medical operations, the fact that the South African law right now is very weak and it basically grants patents that are undeserved, it's an issue of life and death.
But patents aren't driving the cost of healthcare, according to Public Affairs Engagement, which says even the prospect of the law reforms may be having an impact already on investor sentiment.
Dollars and other kinds of investments are going to flow to countries that have the kind of regimes that are much more welcoming to innovation and investment. That's just a fact. And I think it's getting very competitive. And the decline in the rand, I think, can be traced in part to some of the activities of the last few weeks.
But campaign groups accuse the U.S. pharmaceutical industry of using scare tactics they say South Africa's seen many times before.
They all the time also use arguments of fear on investment and a loss of jobs.
But the Washington-based lobbying firm Public Affairs Engagement rejects that claim, instead pointing to what it sees as the wider implications of the looming war over drug prices in South Africa. It wants to see a public debate, a message it says it continues to stand by. Again, Ambassador James Glassman.
Well, the message that taking a wrong turn on intellectual property will be damaging to the South African economy and South Africans. Absolutely.
The U.S. lobbying firm Public Affairs Engagement has made it very clear that it does not speak on behalf of the U.S. pharmaceutical industry. But it is calling on South Africa to have a long, hard think before it starts making it considerably harder for multinationals to protect their patented drugs. And it's warning that other emerging markets would be ill-advised to follow suit at a time when foreign investors are thinking twice about the health of those economies. Nina Maria Potts, Washington.
A new law in Afghanistan could see women become victims of violence at the hands of male members of their own families, without any fear of criminal prosecution. Human rights campaigners say the section of the Act which allows men to attack their wives, children and sisters without fear of judicial punishment would undo years of slow progress in tackling violence. For more on what this law could mean for women in Afghanistan, FSN's Rebecca Hume spoke with Heather Barr, senior researcher on Afghanistan at Human Rights Watch.
Well, this is actually a law which has been the result of 6 years of work. It's not a law that's specifically about women's rights. It's a new criminal procedure code, which is a major piece of legislation, the The translated version is 128 pages long. But what happened is that last spring, at the last minute, after the law supposedly had been finalized and was ready to be sent to the parliament, it was at the Ministry of Justice, and this new provision was added, which hadn't previously been part of the draft, which says that one of the categories of people who are not permitted to testify in a criminal trial are the relatives of the accused person.
Now, essentially, what does this law enable men to do, and which sections of this law are being contested?
Well, there's one article which says this, and it's Article 26 of the new law. And basically what it means in terms of women who are victims of crime is that if that crime has happened within the family, neither they nor their relatives, other people who might be part of the household, will be able to testify if this law is signed by President Karzai.
Now, obviously, this puts many women in the country in an extremely vulnerable position here, particularly in terms of protection of their rights. How can women potentially, if this law is signed into effect, how can they protect themselves?
Well, it's very hard to see how women will be able to take any kind of action if they're the victims of forced marriage, child marriage, domestic violence, if this provision becomes law. And this is so sad because that's essentially what the situation was in Afghanistan under the Taliban. You know, there was one major reform that happened in terms of law reform for women's rights since 2001, and that was a law that was signed by President Karzai in 2009 called the Law on Elimination of Violence Against Women. That law made rape a crime for the first time under Afghan law. It made forced marriage and child marriage crimes, set tough new penalties for domestic violence. So it was hailed as a really important achievement. But this law, if it's passed, if it's signed by that same president, will sort of rip the guts out of the Law on Elimination of Violence Against Women.
It seems very contradictory that these new laws that were so progressive sort of came into effect, and now we could be seeing something that takes us back to square one. Do we actually think it's likely the president will sign this?
President Karzai was quite strong on human rights issues in general and on women's rights, but we've seen that kind of commitment erode significantly over recent years.
Heather Barr, senior researcher on Afghanistan at Human Rights Watch. Now, the stage is set for Friday's opening ceremonies at the Winter Olympics in the Russian city of Sochi, where tight security is on display. Russian President Vladimir Putin has ordered tens of thousands of extra police to secure the Olympic venues, and the Russian authorities say they'll also use drones, anti-aircraft batteries, and the country's navy in a bid to prevent any kind of terrorist attack. From Sochi, FSN's Anya Ardaeva reports.
On the surface, the area around the Olympic Park in Sochi looks calm and peaceful. But a closer look reveals heavy security all around the area. More than 40,000 police and soldiers were brought here to guard the Olympics, and their visible and invisible presence is everywhere. Sochi was put on high alert in early January, 1 month before the opening of the Games, following 3 suicide bombings in the city of Volgograd last year. A militant group from Dagestan claimed responsibility for the bombings, which killed 34 people and threatened to strike the Olympic Games. Dagestan is just a few hundred kilometers away from Sochi. Timothy Stanley is the managing director of the Global Risks Consultancy Group.
From what we've seen so far, the Russian authorities are doing absolutely everything in their power to try and make sure that any threat to Sochi Olympic Games is minimized. They're doing exactly what anybody in Europe, anybody in North America, anybody in Asia would do faced with a similar threat. Does that mean they are able to completely eliminate the threat? No, of course it doesn't.
The sophisticated high-tech gear that Russia deployed to provide security at the Games includes air defense missiles, high-speed patrol boats, and drones, capable of defending the city from air and sea attacks. However, the most likely threat, observers say, are suicide bombers with primitive explosives, and they're much more difficult to track down. Following the attacks on Volgograd, police in Sochi issued a warning about several potential suicide bombers, including a 22-year-old widow of an Islamic militant, who police said was at large in the city. The country's officials, however, ensured that nothing could happen to over 5,500 athletes and some 25,000 volunteers during the Games.
In the pre-planned work for the security of the Olympics, we looked at all potential possible threats, and the existing forces present today in the region around the Olympics are ready to react to any threats to safety and will not allow the carrying out of any hostile acts against participants or guests. Definitely not only our information, but the information of our partners shows that at the current time a real threat to the Games does not exist.
With all the heavy security measures now in place in the area, one official said Sochi was now the safest place on the planet. However, observers warn that with all the attention now focused on the security of the Olympic Games, terrorists could strike elsewhere, not necessarily in Sochi.
Correspondent Anya Ardaeva. And you'll hear more of her reports from Sochi in the coming days on FSN Reports as the Games get underway. And finally tonight... The sound of Milwaukee Symphony Orchestra concertmaster Frank Almond playing the Lipinski Stradivarius violin before it was stolen last week. The 300-year-old instrument has now been recovered and several arrests made in connection with the theft. Earlier, I spoke to art recovery expert Robert Whitman, who explained why this particular instrument would have caught the criminal ear.
Well, the instrument itself is called the Lipinski violin. It's a very famous Stradivarius. It's one of about 650 that are known throughout the world. Stradivariuses in and of themselves are very valuable. This particular one is valued anywhere between $3 and $6 million.
So talk us through what happens. That the priceless artwork or priceless instrument is stolen. What next?
Well, as I say in a book I wrote called Priceless, How I Went Undercover to Rescue the World's Stolen Treasure, I talk about cases all around the world where individuals go out and they make these crimes. They go out and steal. They're very good business. They're very good thieves, but they're terrible businessmen. And so what they do is they plan the crime. They go out and execute the crime, but then they don't know what to do with the objects of art or a Stradivarius violin, whatever it's going to be. They don't know what to do with it after they have it. And they don't understand that the uniqueness of the art or the violin is what makes it valuable. The other problem they have is they don't have a good title. And when you don't have a good title to an object, you can't sell it. So therefore, it's very difficult to monetize them. Generally, throughout my career at the FBI as the senior investigator of the National Art Crime Team, I saw that a general idea of value in the quote, black market, if there was one, is about 10% of actual value. So, you know, a piece like that, you might offer $300,000-$400,000 for it and for sale as a black market number.
And over your long career in art recovery, what was the most expensive piece you managed to reunite with its owner?
Well, I think the most expensive piece was a document that I recovered back in 2003. It was one of the original copies of the Bill of Rights, which is a very, very important document in American history. This particular piece was actually sent by George Washington to the state of North Carolina in 1789 to be ratified. And this document was stolen in 1865 by a Union trooper during the American Civil War. So we recovered it in 2003. It was valued in some areas at about $100 million.
Arts recovery expert Robert Whitman. And that's the Thursday edition of FSN Reports. Remember, you can contact us via email, reports@featurestory.com. That's reports@featurestory.com. And you can follow us on Twitter. We're there at Feature Story. Coming up on Friday, the Winter Games begin in Russia amid a storm of controversy. Our Sochi correspondent will have all the details. That's Friday, but for now, I'm Kevin McAleese in Washington, alongside producer Rebecca Hume and Rebecca Foster on the Bulletin Desk. For everyone with Feature Story News everywhere, have a great evening. Goodbye.